Businesses are ready to take the plunge.
They're not spending it quite as freely as they were a few months ago, but the pressure to expand, to spend, will be there. And so they will, in time, hire again.
If oil prices start climbing again, Berevesh says it could kill the recovery. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Carson in Washington.
Germans on the alert for E. coli contamination are being warned to stay away from locally grown bean sprouts. Though tests are not conclusive, authorities say they believe sprouts are the culprit in the E. coli outbreak that has killed at least 29 people and sickened thousands. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is down 134 points at 11,990. NASDAQ also down more than 30 at 2654. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. This year, our program turned 30, and we've been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. Now, these are shows that have not been heard in many years, not since they were first broadcast, and they touch on topics that we think are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. In this installment of what we have been calling the Deep Archives Project, you will hear edited portions of two shows that explore the importance of lifelong learning and also the changes in the way that we think about aging. Mary Catherine Bateson is an anthropologist, and she is the daughter of two rather famous anthropologists, Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson, and she spent much of her career writing about the way that we learn. That is the subject of her book, Peripheral Visions, Learning Along the Way, and she talked about that book on this show. Back then we called it Focus 580, and this was in June of 1994. Mary Catherine Bateson argues that the way that we think about learning is much too rigid and too narrow. And she encourages us to think about learning as something that happens throughout our lives and not just when we are in the classroom.
One of the problems with schooling and with education is that in school, people learn that there is a right answer, and they learn to be uncomfortable if they don't know it. Every one of us has memories of how awful it felt in school not to know the answers, to come to class unprepared. In fact, a lot of adults still have dreams, as I have to admit I do, of showing up for an exam that they haven't prepared for.
So do I.
Okay. Now, what you've got to realize is that anxiety works against you. Because in a real sense, life is an exam that you haven't prepared for. And fortunately, you're not going to get a simple grade on it. And there are many alternatives, but we constantly encounter situations where we have knowledge that helps us respond. We have materials to use in a response, but we have to put it together on the spot and improvise. And very important in that improvisation is not being defensive, not feeling that it should be cut and dried. Defensiveness works against willingness to learn and often poisons interactions with other people with different cultural or religious backgrounds. You know, sometimes I have my students interview their own grandparents. Now, sometimes their grandparents were immigrants. Sometimes their grandparents were born in this country, but they were born in a different era, so that they themselves are immigrants through time, as we all are becoming. And sometimes, of course, people don't have a living grandparent, and they can seek out someone from a different generation who is not actually related. But the interesting thing is how often they come back and they say, I never realized how different things were. I never had the flavor of a different point of view, a different way of experiencing the world that you get from talking about important life experiences with someone who experienced them in a different setting.
I was intrigued by your use of the word improvisation in dealing with different life situations. You use it throughout the book in one section in particular, and the word is in the title of the first chapter. And it started me thinking about the way we think about schools and what happens in schools and the kind of demands that people put on schools. And the fact that there are some people who would not feel comfortable with the idea of improvisation, particularly when it comes to teaching children. Because going back to your earlier thought about how we get into the classroom and we get pretty tense because we think that there is one right answer and we're not sure that we know what it is. I guess there are people who say there are certain questions where there is indeed one right answer, and that's what we want our children to get. They don't want their children to improvise. And to carry that metaphor on, you know, they want their children to be given a part to play and read their lines and don't depart from the script. And I wonder how you think about that, and particularly how you might respond to somebody who has that kind of concern when it comes to schools and the idea that maybe there was too much freedom and it's not always a good thing to encourage children to improvise.
Well, I think there are a lot of different layers to that question, David. First of all, I think everybody improvises. Even if we have a script we go in with, it's not a contradiction in terms to talk about practicing improvisation. Jazz musicians do it all the time. They practice and practice and practice, and that frees them to be spontaneous. And you deal with a situation, you're suddenly, you have an injury, you miss your plane and you have to figure out what to do next. You use information you have to put together a way of responding. And if people think about their own lives, they will be able to find examples of occasions where they have had to improvise and improvise successfully. I talked earlier about communication between adults and children. You know, a child asks a question, and you have to try and answer in terms that will be intelligible. You have to make a translation of your own knowledge to that particular situation. So that's one part of the question. I think it is good for people to examine their own experience for this issue of improvisation. And particularly what I phrase in the first chapter, I'm talking about myself trying to communicate to my child. I'm talking about improvising responsibly and with love. You know, this is not just a matter of off the wall, doesn't matter what you do. It's a matter of adapting to a particular situation. And the other thing that I talk about that's really quite an important theme in the book is the relationship between continuity and change. sometimes we think there's one group of people that want to keep things the way they are, and we call them conservative, and another group of people that are in love with change, and we see these as opposite directions. But it often happens in life that you have to accept superficial change in order to achieve fundamental continuity. I use the example of talking about nuns' habits. You know, when the Catholic religious orders developed in the Middle Ages, the garments that were developed that nuns would wear were essentially based on the ordinary clothing of respectable and modest women. They weren't that different from ordinary clothes. Well, what happened? They got frozen. Clothing and how people wore it kept changing around them, and these medieval garments were frozen so that what looked ordinary became grotesque. It created a separation from other people rather than being kind of intelligible and recognizable. So finally, nowadays, about 20 years ago, all of those things got reformed so that once again Catholic nuns wear clothes that are like those of ordinary people, but simple and modest and non-extravagant. That's an example of how freezing something, trying to keep it the same, makes it different because the context has changed. And if you want to perpetuate a more fundamental continuity, you have to be willing to make changes in less fundamental matters.
Well, let's talk with somebody here who is listening. We have a caller in Kankakee.
Mm-hmm.
On line four. Hello.
Hello. I was interested in the strategies that your speaker had in teaching and the assignments she might use to help students create that kind of thinking that she's talking about. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thank you for that question. I should say first that my own teaching has always been at the college level, that I'm not an expert on elementary or secondary education by any means. And I think the implications of this book for school reform will come about more through adults looking at their own experience and thinking about how schools could be improved to put them in a better position to go on learning throughout their lives. So this is not really a book with an agenda about school reform. But I can give you some examples of what I do and of what I think needs to be done. I think Maybe I need to talk for just a minute about a term we've all heard that is tremendously debated because it is used in different ways, and that's multiculturalism. People use it really to talk about opposite ideas. One idea is the need that children have to feel rooted in their own cultural tradition, and to value that tradition. And this would have to do with an early exposure for members of different groups in the society to their own traditions. And I call that identity multiculturalism. You need to have a sense of being at home somewhere before you can be at home everywhere. But then I think we all need exposure to different traditions, because it is this exposure that equips us with the flexibility to make us adaptable. So I also talk about adaptive multiculturalism, and I think every member of the society needs to learn about other traditions. And sometimes, just as members of minority groups have felt that they didn't get their own traditions supported, it sometimes happens that members of a majority are allowed to become too narrow and don't have the privileges of exposure to other traditions. So one thing I would say in terms of multiculturalism is that we should make this distinction in terms of our classroom goals. And I think the sense of one's own tradition is earlier than the sense of other traditions, and we have to start thinking of a movement through the schools from self-esteem to valuing of one's own tradition to respect and fluency in dealing with other traditions. That's one thing. I gave the example of giving children assignments that send them out to discover for themselves how other people experience the world. I sometimes send, now when I say I do these things, I do them with college students. I send them out to visit a Sunday or Friday or Saturday or whatever service of some religious group they are not a member of. And of course, sometimes I have students who aren't a member of any religious group. Try and understand what is happening here and why. I send them out to interview people who are different from themselves. I often assign autobiographies of people from other traditions so they can ask, how are we the same? How are we different? Another thing that I think is helpful is learning to be an observer. We're learning from things we see out of the corner of our eye, out of peripheral vision, in the environment all the time. But I like to encourage people to become aware of that learning process. So, for instance, going to a supermarket and taking notes on the diversity of different kinds of selections people make. Can you characterize people by their tastes and by what they pick out off the shelves? How about observing clothing? What does it tell you? What does it communicate to you? Going to a park, looking at the way different mothers speak to their children, different styles of disciplining children. And these are all things that we see routinely that you can learn to think about. And then the last thing that I would say is children should learn to apply that kind of observation to their watching of television. We really need to learn to look at the media with a more critical eye, and therefore look at the techniques that are being used, look at the nature of programming, look at the stereotypes that are being presented. This is such an important part of the world. Children should come in to school and report on and discuss commercials and political speeches in order to be intelligent viewers so they can both learn and criticize.
I hope that that gets at the question of the caller. We do have some others, both of them local here. We'll start with an Urbana caller. This is on line number one.
I fear, you know, you're making these suggestions. I fear that the modification of the educational system and the reinvention of the educational system that is proposed at this time is really in the hands of the accountability movement, and that when you have to state objectives, and those people who develop tests, and I used to be one of them, say, look, this is the objective for social studies. And then you have to operationalize that and say, well, you know, let's define this universe and, that we're going to test as social studies, and let's take a sample of things that will be included in the testing instrument. That shuts down a lot of the experiential discovery kinds of strategies that that are just wonderful and important for lifelong learning. That is that the idea in it, as stated in education that you've been sort of talking around is that the learner has to learn to learn.
That's right.
And then they have to learn how to know what they know. You know, it's an a philosophical question about epistemology that they have to explore then too. When we do that, it, number one, it takes time. And every teacher that you talk to in the elementary and secondary school says, we don't have enough time. We're always asked to do more and more. We don't have time for that. And then if students are going to be tested, we have to make sure that they're going to know what's on that test so that we can they can perform well. The tests don't take into account the ability to discover things, the ability to determine one's own knowledge, and to provide a verbalization and expression of that knowledge that's comprehensible to others. Tests don't do that. The accountability system isn't going to allow it. It's wonderful. You have a wonderful idea, but I fear it's going to end up just in the book that you've produced.
Well, first of all, I hope it's going to end up enriching the lives of the adults that read the book and feel defensive when they encounter strangeness, that it will free people up to learn from experience whatever age they are. You know, up in, I think that's an issue when you're in your 90s. But I do agree with you that the whole school reform thing is frightening. I think we are scapegoating teachers and school officials at the moment. I think one of the reasons that they feel under pressure is because we keep adding separate units on this, that, and the other instead of looking for an integration. Gosh, I don't know if I can turn the tide. There are a few stories in this book about classrooms that I've seen in other countries that suggests that when teachers start teaching toward the exam, a lot of other learning stops happening. Teaching for defined objectives automatically loses peripheral vision. You narrow in to a particular goal, and you stop benefiting from learning out of the corner of the eye. One of the things, you know, I think we should ask what people know 10 years out of school, not on graduation day, because then we would know whether they were able to continue to learn, which they have to do since the society changes. I find very often I go on learning from things that I encountered in the classroom 30, 40 years ago that I didn't completely get the first time. And I think, for instance, people who read and reread the Bible know that you don't get it all on the first reading. And it's a mistake to think you do, because you're going to get something different out of it as you go through life. And this is true of much of what we're exposed to in education. You're exposed to it. Hopefully, it stays in your mind. It comes back to your memory, or you read it again. Something triggers it later, and half the learning takes place outside the classroom.
That's anthropologist Mary Catherine Bateson. She was a guest on this show. Back then we called it Focus 580 in June of 1994. And we were talking about her book, Peripheral Visions, Learning Along the Way, a book that is, by the way, still available. In the years since, she has continued to write and speak about learning, as well as the contributions of older adults and intergenerational communication. She is Professor Emerita at George Mason University. This year, our program turned 30, and to celebrate that fact, we dug into our tape collection looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. These are programs that are not part of our web archive, and in most cases, these are shows that have not been heard since they were first broadcast. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project, and you can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you'll find a place that you can leave a comment. You may also write to us at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. The zip is 61801. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Drinking went underground during Prohibition, but under certain circumstances, you could drink legally. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Daniel Okrent about the rise and fall of Prohibition.
You could buy a prescription for $3 from your local physician and then take it to your local pharmacy and have it filled and go home with a pint of liquor every 10 days.
Join us
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is on their new website, trophytime.com. We'll be right back.
is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. This year, the show turned 30, and we have been celebrating that fact by going back into the archives and looking for interesting conversations with interesting people from the distant past, programs that aren't part of our current web archive. And in the second part of the program today, you will be hearing Theodore Roszak. He's an historian and is probably best known for his book, The Making of a Counterculture. That book was published in 1968, and it was his effort to explain the counterculture of the 60s. Of that book, the philosopher Alan Watts wrote, "If you want to know what's happening among your intelligent and mysteriously rebellious children, this is the book." Now, when I talked with Theodore Roszak in 1999, the subject at that point was his book, America the Wise. And in that book, he began with the fact that the children of the 60s, these people he had written about in the counterculture book, they were hitting middle age. And he went on to reflect on how aging in America was changing, how American seniors were changing, and what all of that change meant for the country.
My interest in longevity as a social phenomenon began as a very personal matter. I suddenly realized that I was going to experience it. This was about 10 years ago when I went through a horrendous medical crisis and recovered from it. And then just a few years ago, my wife went through a similar crisis, open-heart surgery. We both came out of those experiences realizing that we were going to live a lot longer, or we were very likely to live a lot longer than our parents or grandparents had. And that, as a matter of fact, we were part of something very big that was happening in the society. It's very simply summarized, more people are living longer. That's the beginning of an idea. As I explored it more deeply, I discovered that that fact is accompanied by another one, which is that families, not only in America but throughout the industrial world, are shrinking, and shrinking dramatically. And that means that every industrial society in the world is experiencing aging as inevitable. It's built into their very structure. And that, it seemed to me, was an astonishing fact, that as industrial societies progress, they are going to get older and older. That will happen inevitably. And so the question is, what do we think about that? I don't think we have ever had to recognize the possibility of what may be a permanent senior dominance in our future. We're very used to thinking of ourselves as a youthful society. But in fact, the demographics are very clear. Industrial societies must age. And that, it seems to me, is an astonishing fact. It's unprecedented in human history. By the next century, we will be approaching a point where there will be more people above the age of 50 in most industrial societies than below the age of 50. Never happened before in history.
There has certainly been a lot written in popular media about this demographic trend and the implications of it, and it seems to be largely negative. It is written about as being an enormous problem, or perhaps some collection of problems.
Right, that was the next thing I flashed upon in taking an interest in this subject. In fact, my wife and I, like literally millions of other people, have been offered the gift of life. We are part of this process called aging. And yet everything I was reading about it on all sides was so gloomy and so negative. And so, you know, I decided to sit down and think this through. The gift of life, a longer, healthier life. How can that possibly be a bad thing? By what set of values or cultural assumptions does anybody come to the conclusion that a longer, healthier life for more and more people is a bad thing? It seemed to me it was a very good thing. In fact, I'm prepared to define it in this book as the true wealth of our nation, that we are able to give so many people a longer, healthier life. That led to a lot of political analysis of where this gloomy perception comes from and who it is that believes we can't afford this and that seemingly we should begin demanding a shorter lifespan. And it turns out that it is a very political matter. There are people who are used to the idea that we are a youthful society. They think that's where the market for goods is. An aging society is less of a high consumption society in their view. There are others who feel that big government programs, like entitlements programs, are just plain bad, and now they see that those programs are going to expand. They will have to expand, both Medicare and Social Security. And there are those who simply don't like that on political grounds. But if you stand back from that and think about it in very human and very personal terms, it's a great good thing that's happening. Mm.
Central, I think, to the book is the idea that the people that were a part of the what you called the counterculture, the people who were the political social
right.
activists of the 60s, these are the folks now that are entering upon their golden years, or at least these are the people that they're now starting to move into their 50s.
Yeah.
And that you're arguing that as then they get older and they make up the bulk of older Americans, that the attitudes that they bring with them, their life experiences, the state of their health, the degree of their education, everything that makes up who they are will lead us to think very differently perhaps about aging and about the advantages of having the bulk of the population in these older age cohorts.
Absolutely. At some point you have to ask a question. Who is it that's doing this aging? Every generation, after all, has had a different historical experience. The population we're talking about now, as part of this longevity revolution, is the baby boom population of the United States, people born between the 40s and the mid-60s, who are going into their senior years in the next 10, 20, 30 years. Now, that generation has had its own peculiar history, just as every generation before it has had. But it does turn out that that generation of Americans is the best educated, the most politically savvy and engaged generation of Americans that we have ever seen. It will live through a period of great protest. It is used to thinking daring new ideas. It seems to me that there's a very special population that's leading us into this new demographic frontier. It's a population that does not have many of the characteristics of previous older generations. And for one thing, it's just a very big generation. You know, we are one of the most difficult adjustments we are going to have to make is recognizing that we can no longer think of older Americans or the elderly as a small, scattered, powerless group of people about whom we ask, what are we going to do for them? Right. That question is passing from our politics. It simply doesn't make sense anymore. We're talking about a society where older and elderly people will control the bulk of our national wealth. They will do most of the voting. They are going to decide what we're going to do with them. Mm. And they are no longer a small, scattered, powerless group of people. Political power is shifting into their hands. And that makes an enormous difference. We have never had to think about older people, the elderly, as being, as having power as well as wealth. You know, the words poor, old have always gone together. Well, mm-hmm. That's not going to be true in the future.
Well, you know, I'm interested in maybe picking up here for a moment on the last point that you made, because it's my perception that that seniors have been a group that has exercised at least some influence in politics on some perhaps limited range of issues, and that they have exercised that influence because politicians have appreciated the fact that they do indeed vote and perhaps are more inclined to participate politically than younger people. So for that reason, you know, politicians have taken certain stands on certain issues, particularly things like Medicare, Social Security, mm-hmm. and so forth. If indeed that older Americans become more, say, it becomes a larger group, mm-hmm. and given the fact that they are motivated to investigate social issues and work on that motivation not only by voting and other sorts of things. I mean, if this becomes an even more important block in terms of national politics, how do you see that shaping or influencing politics? What will be the implications of that?
We have been aware of the growing voting strength of the senior population ever since the 1970s, mm-hmm. and through the 80s and into the 90s. But by and large, our perception of that voting strength has identified older voters as an interest group, that has only a couple of interests, namely Social Security and health care, Medicare. And that was may have been true back in the 70s and 80s. But bear in mind what I'm saying. This older, the next older population is not going to be a small a interest group. It's going to be the major. It's going to grow toward being the majority of our citizen body, and that means that it has not only more power, but it has more responsibility. In fact, one of the purposes I wrote, for which I wrote the book, was to encourage older Americans, especially baby boomers, as they move into that period of life, to recognize their responsibility. They can no longer pretend or aspire to being little more than an interest group voting for their self-interest, because what they're going to be voting for in the way of Social Security and Medicare as their most immediate interests will impact every other economic priority in the society. Therefore, they're going to have to look for a broader, more balanced view of how we allocate our national wealth, precisely because there will be so many of them. They're going to find that they're not asking for a small part of the pie, the national pie. They're asking for a very large part of the pie. And that's going to impact things like education and the environmental cleanup and military expenditures and everything else in the society. So the next generation of seniors, precisely because it is going to be so large and have such such strong needs, is going to have to take a much larger view of its place in our society. Now, in the past, senior voters have not had to think that way. They've been able to say, look, we're a small group of people. We have a certain interest. We're going to vote to defend that. And they could afford, in a sense, to be selfish about that. That's not going to work in the future, because their selfish interest is now going to have such an enormous impact upon the rest of the society that they're going to have to have to grow up and recognize that we have a power that brings with it an enormous responsibility. So in the book, I appeal, it's a sort of a mission statement for the next senior generation to be as noble and as generous and as public-spirited as they can possibly imagine being. They have to become a different kind of a citizen, a different kind of a senior citizen. They have to bear the public good, the public interest as a whole, firmly in mind.
So you, in your mind, though, that whether or not this group of folks you're talking about, the new people, that's the phrase that you described.
Yeah, I use it in the book to be dramatic about how different this is going to make us as a society, yes.
Well, it still seems to be, in your mind, an open question of whether, indeed, they'll rise to the challenge or not?
Well, of course. I mean, because you're talking about an enormous number of people, you know, some 80 million Americans going through a major demographic transition in their lives. You take your life in your hands trying to make a firm prediction about what will happen. So the book is partially predictive, but it's also an appeal to people to recognize that our political demographic situation is shifting radically, and that requires rethinking a number of things in our society. For example, it requires rethinking how rich we are as a society. You know, the major gloomy prediction about the aging of our society is grounded in the idea that we just don't have enough money to afford this. And you hear that again and again. Social Security, Medicare, they're all dooming us to a fiscal train wreck. Well, in writing the book, you know, I simply reviewed what I think we should all become aware of. We are a very rich society. We spend twice as much every year on gambling, than we spend on Medicare. So when you raise the question, can we afford Medicare, can we afford Social Security, you have to ask, well, what are we now spending that money on? Ask the question what we can afford as a people when you're standing in the middle of a shopping mall, right? And you look at all the consumer goods around you. We're an enormously rich society. We have more than enough to afford what other industrial societies are affording for their senior population and for the Social Security of their population as a whole. And I think those issues are going to come home to us very dramatically within the next 10 to 20 years when we finally sit down and say, what is it we want to use this money for? And I think it will occur to us that long life and good health this is the one expenditure on which there is an enormous public consensus. I cannot imagine anybody taking issue with that.
I think it's also the case, and you write about it and you comment on it, that it seems that the people that we're talking about also are not going gently into their senior years. They are just as enthusiastically, many of them, committed to the cult of youth of this country as anybody else, and seem to be sometimes grasping at whatever pill or surgery or product or item of clothing or material possession or whatever it is that they think is going to keep them from getting old.
Yep, that's true.
It seems to be that what we're going to have to become mature also in the way that we think about maturity, and that abandon that sort of idea that says that you don't, if you don't want to, you don't have to get old.
That's absolutely right. In fact, that's one of the things that is one of the great ironies about the longevity revolution. The very population that's now leading us into the demographic frontier we're discussing, the aging of our society, is the same population that stamped us with a national identity of youth back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that image of America as a youthful society is still with us in all of our advertising, in all the commercials you see. Our media are still skewed toward what's called the young demographic, 18 to 34. It means that the media and the advertising people have not yet caught up with the wave of the future. They're in a sense, waging war against the United States Census Bureau. They haven't recognized yet. They're reluctant to recognize that we are an aging society. And so in their view, aging is something wrong. It's something unnatural. It's something that shouldn't be happening. But, of course, it is going to happen, and eventually they will have to adjust to the fact that the older population, well above the age of 50, is where the money is and it's where the numbers are. And that will happen inevitably because you can't just keep ignoring a massive fact like that.
There are countries that are ahead of us on the demographic curve, in the sense that it's happening more rapidly because they are either at or actually below replacement level in their birth rate.
Yeah.
As you look at, you cast your eyes around the world and look at in other places, is there anyone who would serve as a model for us, would suggest this is the way to approach it, or are they having
I can nominate one country right away, and that is the Scandinavian countries.
Hmm.
Scandinavian countries now have a life expectancy up into the 80s. And they have very generous programs, not only for senior citizens, mind you, but for children and young marrieds. They have a highly developed social security program. Now, they pay very high taxes for that. I mean, that's one of the first things people always observe. They do. But on the other hand, the program works very well for all concerned. I mean, I have visited Sweden, and it seems that they are very content with their system. Now, we may not be able to do that. But what has been interesting to me is the number of conservative elements in our society who have suggested that we shouldn't imitate Scandinavia, we should imitate Chile. And they keep pushing the Chilean model of how to handle retirement, which is, incidentally, a very speculative matter of putting the money in the stock market, and it has not been working out terribly well lately. Well, you know, if I had to choose a model from all the world, I would choose Scandinavia rather than Chile. The country that's actually working out these problems in a way that may speak to our condition is Japan. The Japanese are now the oldest society in the history of the world. They have more people above the age of 65 than below 16. And they are adjusting in the direction of more and more generous social security for their senior citizens. The other industrial countries, including the United States, have been very critical of their efforts to do that. But I suspect that Japan, which is working this out now, currently, over the next generation, is pretty much our future. We should be looking to what they're doing and learning from their efforts, and indeed from some of their troubles and problems.
Do you find yourself, I wonder, feeling optimistic that as we grow old, we're going to grow up?
Well, look, here's my major orientation. We have been talking about aging as some kind of a calamity that we can't afford. I've decided to look at it in a very different way. This has been one devil of a century to live through. World wars, revolutions, the atomic bomb, the balance of terror, genocide, ethnic cleansing. I mean, the number of terrible and evil things that have happened in the 20th century is enormous. But you know, one good thing has happened. More people are living longer. I think we should cling to that and value it and say this is the one thing that's come out of this troubled century that is of benefit to all of us, that we can all share in longer, healthier lives. That is inevitable, and it is good. And I haven't seen many people talking about this change in that way. Well, I think we have to start thinking of it that way. What's the alternative to a longer, healthier life? Are we going to advocate shorter, sicker lives? And on the other hand, why don't we just think of this as good? This is what the money is for. This is what the whole industrial process has been for, to bring us to this condition. We've got it. We should value it and make the most of it.
And that is Theodore Roszak. He was a guest on this program in February of 1999, and we were talking about his book, America the Wise. He's written on a range of subjects, including aging in America, but also eco-psychology and gender. He's also published several novels. His best work, though, remains, best known work remains The Making of a Counterculture. That was a book first published in 1968. He's professor emeritus at California State University at East Bay. We're celebrating the 30th anniversary of this program by going back and bringing back some very old interviews, some that have not been heard since we first broadcast them. And we're calling it the Deep Archives Project. You can tell us what you think by going to our web page, go to the focus section. You can leave a comment there, or you can just drop us a line the conventional way. We're at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. 61801 is the zip, and we'll do this again in another couple of weeks. Coming up on Monday, let me just mention that in the first hour, the guest will be Gretchen Morgenson. She's a reporter for the New York Times, and we will go back and talk again about the financial meltdown and what happened and why. Her book on the subject is Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. And then in the second hour, this is a program that we do every other month. It's a show dedicated to giving you the chance to ask some basic questions about your health. And our guest for the show is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician, family medicine doctor with the Carl Physician Group in Urbana. And every other month on a Monday, he's on the program and we just open it right up. He deals with people of all ages in his practice. So if you have questions for yourself or for someone in your family, that question will be welcome. We're on the air here Monday through Friday, 10 different topics every week, and you can always check on the schedule by going to our website, will.illinois.edu.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, with four area locations, inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com.
That's it for Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices, how the contracts are faring in Chicago and in Kansas City. In Kansas City, July wheat trading at 867 and three quarters, down 3.5. September, 886, down 3.75. July wheat in Chicago is up 12.25 at 757.25. September, 783.5, up 3/4. July corn, 796, up 10.5. September, 757.25, up 3.25. December, 711.5, down 2.5. And the March contract down 2.25 at 722. July soybeans, 1389 and three quarters, down 4. August, 1384.5, down 2.75. September, 1380.5, down 4.75. November, 1382, down 4.75. July soybean meal, 373.70, up 80. July soybean oil, 56.98, down 42. June live cattle, 102.90, down 172.5. August, 103.75, down 167.5. August feeder cattle, 124.05, down 127.5. and a half. June lean hogs, 91.72 and a half. That's up 127 and a half. July crude, 99.31, down 2.62. The U.S. dollar, 74.75. That's up 56. The CRB index, 348.08, down 2.76. The Dow is off 128 at 11,996. The S&P 500 off 14 at 12.75. And the NASDAQ is down 30 at 26.55. At noon Central Time, 83 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. We're looking for